Welcome to the Home Tech Podcast, show number 5, recorded December 30th, 2010. The podcast for you and your friends with tech questions, where your family's tech guys can't figure out the latest iPod, problems with your smartphone, your PC not working right, or in my case, every PC in the house not working right. You've reached the right destination. We talk tech, but for the average guy. So, first live show tonight on Ustream, so we welcome the Ustreamers, and thanks for coming out. If you're listening to this recorded, you missed us on Ustream, and from time to time, we'll jump out there and get that done. But Ustreamers who are out there tonight, appreciate you coming out live. Tonight, I'm joined by a couple guys that have been podcasting with us now for a couple shows. Brian Burgess. Brian is a longtime blogger over at How To Geek, and is now blogging for simplehelp.net. And as well as right here at theaverageguy.tv. Brian, you've been sick, but how are you doing tonight?
I think I'll make it.
You think you'll live, huh?
Yep.
How are things going over at simplehelp.net? You getting posts out there as well?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's going really well. With the holidays and everything, I haven't had a whole lot of time to get a lot done. But once the holiday season's over here, we'll get some more posts up there.
Get back to work. Everybody's got to get back to work on the 3rd. I don't work tomorrow, Saturday, or Sunday, but I know it's coming on Monday, so that's always kind of a bummer. Christian's with us tonight, Christian Johnson. He's a developer over at Maple Grove Partners and a website administrator, actually my website administrator. Sorry for breaking the website last night, Christian. and runs BIOS Mods. And recently released a Windows Home Server add-in, Magic Wake on LAN. Did I get that right, or is it Wake? Yeah, Magic Wake on LAN.
Yep, that's right.
Yeah, how's that going?
It's going well, actually. Doing much better than I anticipated for the holiday season. A couple more intriguing positive results came in last night. And I hope to see some renewed interest and effort after the holidays, so that the people who missed it will get back in there. So
we mentioned it last night on the Home Server show, kind of in passing, but I know as folks again get back to work and such that hopefully you get some visibility on that and pick up some sales on it. So good for you. Of course, I'm Jim Collison. I podcast with the homeservershow.com, and I write here, and we are here to see you and talk to you tonight. All right, guys. Christmas came and went, and lots of course, at least here in the United States, lots of retail dollars are exchanged during the Christmas time, and tech gifts are given. Sometimes we buy them for people. Sometimes people give them to us, and sometimes we just even buy them for ourselves. And so that's all fun. Christian, I know you got kind of a sweet gift for Christmas. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what Santa brought for you?
Yeah, I decided to open up the presents early, and what came to me but a new AMD Phenom 6 core, which is AMD's top-of-the-line 6-core processor, and built a whole new system from scratch on a ASUS Crosshair 4 Formula motherboard, 8 gigabytes of DDR3 RAM. And wow, it's unbelievable, spectacular performance. I could go into specs all night, but I don't want to drive people to tears with boredom. But it's performance bench-wise for the price of the hardware. It is very competitive with Intel, and nothing I've been able to throw at it has stopped it thus far. So remains to be seen.
If a lot of people are familiar with Intel's Core series, Core i3, Core i5, Core i7. How does it relate, let's say, to the Core i7, which is not necessarily the top of the line, but it's pretty far up there.
Right, yeah. This is definitely, if you were to line it up and try and compare it to Intel, it would be in the i7 range. The AMD, the processor that I got, which is the 6-core Black Edition, which means that you can overclock it with, like, you hit one button and it goes up another gigahertz without doing much work. But it compares with the Intel i7-950, which is pretty close to the very top line. There are a couple processors ahead of it in the Xeon series. But for the most part, it's a very competitive desktop processor, not just in performance, but price-wise and availability, which sometimes for people trying to buy a top-of-the-line processor, AMD is the best way to go if you're trying to get an economy solution rather than paying top dollar for it. So
cool. One of the things you mentioned to me, I think yesterday, was that it had a a 7.5 or a 7.9 performance rating. Now, this is something the average guy can kind of get their hands around. So if you go, if you're on Windows 7 and you go Start Computer and right-click on that and go to Properties, right, there's some tests that you can run, and it's called the Windows Experience Index. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so you can go in there and run that setting, and it'll come back with kind of a score. Now, I have I'm running an Intel Core i3, so the bottom of the line series, and really that score comes off of what's the slowest component or the that gets the worst score, right? They don't average it. It's
right.
Just whatever has the lowest score. In this case, mine's like a 5.2. Yours is like a 7.5, is that what you said?
Right. The actual overall score that shows up in the one number, I believe, is 5.5 because of the hard disk.
Okay.
I have not replaced with a in the mail coming, I think it's a Raptor or a Samsung, but it's hopefully going to be a hard drive that gets much better performance than the one in there. But if you open up the experience index and break it down by different components, both the memory and the CPU without overclock score 7.5. So if you were to kick it up, you'd probably get very close to 7.9.
Okay, and in the overclocking. And my CPU is at like a 6.9. So there's there must be not too much space in between. I would have expected that Core i3 to be a lot slower or a lot less of a score. But that's so if you got a new PC at Christmas and you got Windows 7 maybe for the first time, we've talked about that before with a lot of folks getting Windows 7 on new PCs. Try that index. Sometimes it's not run by the manufacturer, and so you can run it for the first time. It'll run through a bunch of tests and then give you a score. Brian, have you done that on your PC while we've been talking?
Yeah, I have. My rating is a 5.9.
Okay.
I'm in your boat, too. I have a Core i3.
Yeah.
2.9 gigahertz with 6 gigabytes of RAM.
Yeah, what did your Core i3 score?
Oh, I don't have that front of me.
Click on the see where it says the rating right next to the rating. It says Windows Experience Index. There's a little link there. Click on that, and that'll blow
refresh.
It out. It'll
yeah.
Does it give you a score for the processor individually?
Yeah, 6.9.
Oh, okay. All right. So that's good. See, it's good to see that those scored equally. You know,
yeah.
your Core i3 and my Core i3 got the same score.
Right.
That's good to know. But yeah, it's kind of cool to see where your bottleneck is, right? So if you're experiencing some bottleneck on your PC and you're kind of wondering where that's at, is this a good indicator of where you might start to kind of determine where that is? Do you think, Christian?
Yeah, I'd say it's a pretty fair start, especially because with Vista, the experience index only went up to 5.9. So in Windows 7, they upped the experience index to 7.9 to take into consideration a lot of the new hardware that was just starting to emerge when Windows 7 was released. So you have to remember that even though i3 and i7 may be far away in terms of Intel, they're all quad cores. So this index takes every kind of hardware. So even if you're still running a single core or a dual core, that's where that index plays in. So that'll do a great job of telling you where your hardware lies in terms of in race with state-of-the-art technology.
Sure.
Even my dual core still scores a 5.5, which I don't consider a bad score. I really don't see a huge concern in monitoring your scores for CPU and RAM. Normally, the bottleneck on most people's experience index is the hard drive. And the easiest way to up that is to go straight to Newegg.com and see what kind of offers you can find. But solid-state drives, which don't require the spinning platter, are still relatively expensive. So maybe more economical to look for a faster spinning drive than the one you have right now.
Okay. All right.
To up that score.
Brian, what's your low score there?
Just like Christian said, it's in my primary hard disk.
Okay.
And the data transfer rate, which has given me the 5.9.
Okay. Now, mine's 5.2, and that's in my graphics because I have an integrated graphics chipset in that, so I don't have an extra graphics card on. And I bought the board knowing that. Graphics speed aren't all that important to me. And so I bought it that way. Well, anyways, a tip, if you got a new PC this Christmas or you've never been into that, there's also some links in there that you can click that say, what do these numbers mean? And it gives you kind of a long explanation of that. Microsoft's put that in there for you, as well as tips for improving your computer's performance. And Christian, you were just kind of talking about that, some things that you can do by replacing parts to get that done. There's also at the very bottom, it says you're the last time you ran the score on it. So if it's been a while, maybe you've had Windows 7 for a year and you upgraded a few things, you can go back. That next to that is a link that says rerun the assessment. So you can just rerun it. It takes about 10 or 15 or 20 minutes, and it'll come back with a score. So that's kind of fun. All right. So Christian, any other tech gadgets that you got for Christmas besides the monster?
No, I just spent the time building the monster and tweaking it to my content. So that's what I got.
Did you get the? Now you were having a little driver issue with you were putting that thing to sleep. So at night, do you try you try to put your PC asleep at night? Is that kind of what you do? Okay, so you don't let it run. I let my PCs just run. Maybe that's a bad thing to do, but. Power's free here in the Midwest. I'm just kidding. Maybe in Canada. But so when you were putting it to sleep, did you get that fixed? Is it waking up the way it should now, or is it still blue screening?
Still is giving me – it's a odd combination of either a blue screen or just there's a black screen that doesn't do anything, and you have to hard reset. And this is after it's already gone asleep and you're trying to come back out of sleep. Now, to me – I didn't really care about sleep that much back in Windows XP day. I always either shut down the computer or hibernated it. Vista, I was still using Hibernate. And it wasn't really till Windows 7 that I decided to give sleep a try. And now I really just I depend on it, especially for servers and my desktops, to be able to quickly resume out of a state. It only consumes roughly 2 watts of power per hour. Which really isn't that bad if you consider keeping it on the whole time would be anywhere from 100 to 600 watts depending on what kind of PC you're running. So I like to use it so if I'm out of the house and I need to access my PC quickly, I can wake it up and it'll come out of sleep rather than waiting for everything to turn on and initialize. Sleep seems to be the quickest way to do things over remote, so I really depend on it.
Okay.
And I haven't seen anyone else have the problem with it, so I'm starting to wonder if it's a result of migrating the same operating system to that hardware. What I did was, before I removed it from the old box that the hard drive was on, I went to Device Manager, uninstalled all the old chipset, literally uninstalled all the devices, and then went to a program by Microsoft SysInternals called AutoRuns, which also lets you quickly disable drivers and software that starts up. And I disabled everything I knew was not on the new computer. And then I transferred it over. And when you do that transfer, it sees all these devices are gone, but it also sees all these new devices. So what happens is Windows reinstalls your drivers, and then it'll notice because you have a different motherboard, it's going to make you reactivate your computer, which wasn't a problem. It activated fine. Everything runs like a charm. Still, though, coming out of sleep is the only issue I have, which I've tried just about every driver out there. So at this point, I'm wondering if a reformat is in call for.
There you go. Yeah, back it up and reload. Right?
Yep.
Do you have one of these kilowatt meters?
Yes.
And have you run that to see how what kind of power you're drawing off that?
I have not run that yet, but I really would like to, especially because I'm not sure. I'm still kind of getting used to it. With this new ASUS EPU software, there's a lot of ASUS has like their own ACPI drivers and that kind of stuff. So I'd like to plug it into the kilowatt reader and see what different settings, how that affects the power watts. But I have things like Cool and Quiet and QFan and all that stuff on so that when it doesn't need to crunch numbers, it's really just idling at a very low frequency. So on idle, I don't think it would get over 100 watts, but I bet you if I kicked everything up and had the CPU at 4 gigahertz and had the video graphics up, it would start sucking some juice because that's an 850-watt power supply in there.
You know, I'll be honest with you. I think one of the things that the PC manufacturers, well, and maybe Microsoft here at this point, can do a better job of is power management for the end user. I still think it's very, very confusing for most end users, most average folks, to try and figure out the difference between hibernation and sleep, to try and figure out how do I spin my drives down when I'm not using them? How do I make the most efficient choices? It's not super clear in the software. And so PCs run, you know, I told you, I just leave mine on. And I'm probably wasting a lot of power that I could be recouping by spinning them down at night. Now, your Magic Wake on LAN, the whole purpose or one of the purposes of that is so that the home server can wake that PC up out of sleep, right, back it up and then put it back to sleep, right, during the middle of the night. So it's I think we got a long ways to go, and it's only going to get more important as power gets more and more expensive. I know the folks on the East and the West Coast really struggle with that because power is a lot more expensive out there than it is here in the Midwest. Power is relatively inexpensive, so I don't worry about it. But my friends out in California get killed, when it comes to that. So, well, good. Well, that was I'm sure that was a nice gift to get for Christmas. Yeah, Brian, you and I talked before the show, and you had mentioned you didn't get any tech gifts, but you bought a few for yourself. What'd you get? What'd you buy yourself around the Christmas holiday?
Well, I bought myself an LG Blu-ray player burner for $99 on Newegg.
That's pretty cheap.
Yeah.
For Blu-ray, I mean, those things, it was just a couple years ago, those things were pretty expensive.
Right, exactly. Also, I bought an Xbox 360 Slim.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Nice.
And a Vizio 19-inch HD LCD Razer. Model number is M190VA. I didn't need anything bigger. I rarely watch TV, and it's
except when the Vikings are playing, right?
Except when the Vikings are playing, right? But it's a good size and it's good quality for gaming.
Yeah, and so how are you enjoying the? Did you have a 360 the standard one before?
No, I just had the original model when it first came out years ago.
Yeah.
The
black
doorstop.
One.
Yeah.
the big black one that looked like it would sit flat on the table, the original Xbox.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is your first. Now, you've missed like three different revs of the interface for the 360. I mean, that I think it's gone through at least three different looks and feels for it. How did you, when you fired that thing up for the first time, fairly intuitive for you? How'd that go?
Yeah, absolutely. It's very intuitive. It's a nice user interface. And, you know, being a geek, I want to get into the statistics of it all and there's some really good ways to get a hold of it and find out, like, your MAC address and different system resource type data on it.
Is it pretty quiet?
Yeah, I think so. It's okay. It's more quiet than the original.
Where do you have it? Yeah, that thing was a jet engine. Where did you have it? Where do you have it out? Is it sitting on top of the table somewhere? Is it hidden in an entertainment center? What?
It's sitting on a desk next to my command central.
Okay.
Where I have four screens and all my computers. So
yeah. So it's not. Did you set this up in a living room kind of environment, or is it just it's just part of your desk?
It's in my office, my home office.
Okay. All right. So you're on your PC and you just kind of slide over to play the Xbox.
Right.
Okay.
Yep.
All right. That works. And did you hook that up to your home server yet?
Not yet. Right. I'm going to write some articles up on it and I'm waiting to get my video capture card so I can take some nice screenshots of it and get some posts out there and show other people how to do it.
Yeah. Yeah, very cool. There's a lot you can do with it. Christian, are you an Xbox family or do you PlayStation or Wii or what's the deal at your place?
No, I don't really have any of the game consoles mostly.
Really?
If I do play games, it's definitely on my PC. I make sure the PC has
PC
the juice
gamer.
To do it.
And are you a Steam guy then for games? Or
I'm not. The one reason hesitation I have with Steam is while I like the pricing and that kind of stuff, they sometimes have trouble with multiplayer on the internet. So, like one of the games I play has several update patches that come out where if you're not on the same version as the other guy, you can't play over multiplayer. So sometimes Steam versions don't get the, even though they get the physical update, the version number shows differently because it's Steam, and then you have trouble playing with people on multiplayer. But I enjoy gaming from my PC. You know, I feel like it would be an extra investment for me to spend time configuring those other boxes. Now, some of my relatives do have pretty much every box you can imagine, so I have had my fair share of fun and games on PS2 and 360, and obviously I like them, but do I have them at home and do I use them? No. But
so your favorite game console is a family member's game console, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Yeah. Brian, what do you plan to use the Blu-ray burner for?
Well, for playing Blu-ray discs, data storage, perhaps. It's 25 megabytes for a single disc. 25 gig. Yeah. And 50 for a dual layer.
And that's compared to 4 and 8 gig, right, on a standard DVD, is that right?
Correct, right.
Okay. All right.
But that, and I hope to rip and burn some Blu-ray DVDs, put them on my home server, and be able to enjoy them that way.
Sure.
And then also burn them and, you know, bring them over to my parents or whatever.
Okay.
And we can watch them there.
Do you have it installed?
Not yet. No, I just got it today.
And now, does this Xbox connect through Media Center, or how does that work?
The Xbox? Yes. I haven't configured it on my network yet at all. I just have it hooked up to the TV.
But it does, Christian. You can create it as an extender.
Yeah. Right?
So the Xbox become an extender for Media Center on another PC. So at our house, we use a Sans Digital HD Home Run dual antenna tuner. Boy, that's a lot of words. Basically, that means I can take two antenna feeds from our over-the-air HD, bring those in, and then I install a little software on the Media Center, and it then finds that tuner and allows me to record all that over-the-air HD content, and it's fabulous. I mean, it's free. Mm-hmm. I don't pay anything for that, for the cable, or for the over-the-air stuff. And then Media Center records it, and then we just stream it out through the Xbox to the TV out in the living room, and that works real well. So that's a good way of doing it. We also do it with an analog cable card. So you can have, I think I can have three channels recording at any given time. So that works pretty well. In fact, I just took this evening, I ordered some, our cable provider had a special, and you could order for free, you could get all these different cable channels, and they gave me a cable box. And
I
just left it in the, or not, yeah, or a cable, you know, you had a tuner, right?
Right.
I just left it in the box. I didn't even pull it out. I just hooked my Media Center right up to it. It got the channels we needed. I pulled down I knew it was going to go away eventually, so I just kind of said, I'm not too worried about setting it up perfect because it's going to shut off in a month or two anyways. But yeah, that works real well for that, Brian. When you get to that spot,
right.
Setting that up is pretty easy. I do find about every 2 months it loses itself to the Media Center, and I've got to go back in and manually configure it to put it back.
Really?
So it'll find itself. Yeah, and I have the older Xbox, so I don't know if it's that, if it's our network. I mean, I got a lot of jankety wires hanging around the house. So,
yeah.
You know, maybe it's configuration or something, but.
Yeah, basically the reason I bought it was for the home networking aspects, you know, connecting it to Windows Media Center and a home server. I don't game a whole lot, but buying it now, there's a lot of platinum hits out there for Xbox 360 that are like, you know, $20 or less. So that's kind of neat for me.
Yeah,
you know, I don't need to spend $50 on the newest game.
That gets expensive. $50-$60 a shot is, I guess, a little expensive. But the gamers, I find they don't even care. They don't even think about it. They're like, okay, next new game. I got it. It's in and going. Did you get anything else, Brian? Any other stuff you bought for yourself?
No.
Xbox.
Have a video capture card coming in, and then also a Microsoft Live Cam HD. That should be here tomorrow.
Yeah, that'll be nice. We're doing this podcast via Skype, and we're using Skype 5.0, which has the ability to do multi-channel video.
Group video, yeah.
Group video right there, thanks. And, of course, Brian, we can't see you. So we're anxious to get that, have you get that camera in. That'll be nice.
Yeah, you don't want to see me.
Well, that could be said for all of us. So that's why we're doing an audio podcast, right?
Right.
I got two really cool things, maybe three. I got a Tascam. I mentioned this last night on the Home Server Show, but I got a Tascam DR07 voice recorder for mobile podcasting. So it's got very really nice microphones on top. Comes with a 2 gig SD card. It runs on just 2 AA batteries. It's about the size of a remote control, maybe a smaller remote control, a little thicker than that. Excellent sound quality. And so you can just, we'll be at CES next week. Speaking of that, no show next week, guys, because I'll be at CES. So you guys can take the week off. From this, we'll be doing live reports from the CES show floor, but I got it for CES so I could go around interviewing people and doing podcasts or doing interviews, kind of right there. So that was fun. I did I also got this Energizer here. I'll show it to you, Christian, since you can see it. I got this Energizer phone battery extended battery thing for my phone. And it basically plugs in and gives the phone an extra 125 hours of standby.
Wow.
Yeah, serious. It'll play. It'll take a Nintendo DS. That's the handheld one, right? DS.
Oh yeah, right.
An extra 24 hours of time on that. It's a pretty beefy battery. So the plan is, again, at CES to have that connected to my phone. We're going to shoot a lot of live video off the phone, which is just amazing that you can do that. Vegas has 4G speed, so I actually get to use the 4G that's in my phone. We'll see if that's not all hogged up by everybody, you know, the 120,000 that are at CES. That was fun. Some cool gifts, some cool tech gifts. I did, Drobo sent me on Friday, all my Drobo stuff came. So a Drobo S came, 4 hard drives came from them, and so I was able to kind of finish up my Drobo post. We'll talk about that here in a few minutes. Get the Drobo loaded up with about 5 terabytes of hard drive, and then I have a couple 3 terabyte drives coming to throw in there to take a peek at what those do. And the new Drobo. So it was kind of fun. The kids kept bringing down boxes during the day. I just stayed home on Friday. And so they'd come by and say, "Oh, here's another box, Dad. And here's another box, Dad." It was like Christmas from Drobo. So that was a lot of fun. Hey, any of you guys get any music gift cards in the process? Do you guys?
Yes.
Did you?
Yes, $10 iTunes card.
Nice. Yeah, Brian, any music? Do you buy your music on iTunes or Amazon?
Usually I buy it either from iTunes or Amazon.
Okay.
But I'm still kind of old school, and I still like to purchase CDs.
All right.
And then I rip them to FLAC format, which
What's
is
that?
a lossless format that makes it a bit smaller than the original CD, but not so small that you lose audio quality.
So you have to use what kind of application do you use to rip that?
I use a program called X-Recode, and then also DB Power Amp, and I've also used AEC or EAC Exact Audio Copy as well.
All right.
And that's free. The DB Power Amp's not free, but they do give you a 30-day trial.
Okay, well, that's pretty techie though, right? I mean, that's your average person is gonna take those CDs, they're gonna put them in iTunes, they're gonna let iTunes rip them.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I'm kind of snobby when it comes to the quality of my music, so
yeah. Well, it's a way to do it, right? And certainly when iTunes rips it, it does, you do lose some of the sound quality. Although, you know, Christian, this is a question for you, because it's your generation that doesn't seem to care about music quality anymore, right? They just kind of listen to whatever.
Yeah.
Now you're a musician, so
right.
Do you care more about sound quality than the rest of your contemporaries, or where do you land on that?
Well, I find it interesting because I refuse to listen to anything that's less than 128 kilobits per second. So right. most of your CDs are much higher quality than that. iTunes switched, I think, last year to the new DDRM-free 256 kilobit per second sound, which came at an extra 30 cents per song for some of them. But overall, it's the quickest way to get quality sound off the internet, I think. I don't use Amazon or any of the other things, but most of the people who are my age who are getting music, plug in the iPod, put their gift card number in, buy their song, sync it up, and that's it. You know, yeah. I don't care. And honestly, do I really care that much? No, because the quality on the internet with iTunes and Amazon, some of these other sites are at least 128, which is really good enough for the average person not to hear the difference. Now, if it's like a really high quality FLAC that's encoded at some ridiculous bit rate, sure, you're going to notice the difference. But do you want all these music? You have to remember, the more quality, the larger the file is. So then you would be if people just had all these high quality music tracks, then they would be eating up their iPod space sooner. So it's really a trade-off, but yeah, most people just hit the buy now button and hit the sync button. So
and where do you store your music? I mean, I assume you've got it all digital at this point, mm-hmm. right? And do you guys store it on the home server in a central file called music or a folder called music? Or how do you guys do it?
Sort of, yes. We have two servers that – we have two music servers that run – both powered by Subsonic, which you guys may have heard.
Yeah,
we
talked about
earlier.
That. Yeah.
So I have roughly in the music library 24,000 songs. So you can imagine that's a lot to keep up with and make sure it's available for people outside to listen to and be able to stream off of without any interruption. Stream it to your phone, listen to an album. Just on the ride to Maryland today. It's a 7-hour car ride. I was streaming music off that server the whole time.
Really?
So, yes.
Over your phone?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Music, video. Right. I was
so
able to stream.
You connected your phone to your home server or to the Subsonic server that you have at your house, mm-hmm. right? And we're able to – you got this light over your head that kind of is making you look angelic, by the way. Just
a very bright light.
Yes, it is a bright light. But so you're streaming it right from the Subsonic to your phone, and you just got it plugged in to the car or whatever, and you're listening to it that way.
Yep. Over Bluetooth, we use the Bluetooth, so there's no wires involved.
Right.
And there's no hindrance in quality. It's really the same quality over Bluetooth.
What kind of Bluetooth transmitter do you have?
I'm actually not 100% sure on the model, okay. to be honest with you.
Because those have not been – I haven't had the best luck with them. And okay. they don't. There's not too many models out there. Motorola is probably the most famous or has the biggest
right.
brand name out there. And that, you know, you get in your car, you turn it on, you push a button, it gives you a radio frequency then, right? You tune it into the radio frequency, you Bluetooth connect between your phone or your music player and the device to create the Bluetooth connection, then play it, and it comes out through your radio, whatever channel you're on. For whatever reason, now mine always picks radio stations that have other stations on them, and it's
right,
supposed
yeah.
to do the opposite of that. You know,
well, so we actually have two Bluetooth adapters for the car, because the one car already has the 3-millimeter aux port, so
right.
it doesn't need to go over the radio. It just
yeah.
goes right into the sound system.
Right.
That's really nice. You
yes.
never have problems with that. That's the one I don't know the model of, probably because I've never had a fiddle with it. It
yeah.
just works, you know, and it actually gets really good range too. I'll be inside the house, and when someone outside is starting up the car, my phone will beep and tell me I'm connected, you know. So it's
yeah.
really nice. But yeah. I do know the Motorola we use in our Suburban, because it doesn't have the built-in aux
right.
3-millimeter. And yeah, I definitely know what you mean, especially if you're traveling where the radio stations are changing all the time. You know, you'll be connected. It's really not the Bluetooth connection. It's just when the overhead thing comes on and says, change to 92.7, 93.1, 90.3, and you're just going, and you're listening, and it's really not that bad. I'm over-exaggerating, but sometimes you feel like you're listening to the lady tell you what radio station to go on more than you're listening to your music, which really isn't a big deal if you're driving around local, but it can be tiresome if you're on the road. But yeah, so 24,000 songs to manage. Even Blu-ray movies we've been able to stream over the phone. So that's the latest project.
Yeah,
and it's
great.
Fascinating the quality that you can even get over 3G is exceptionally unbelievable.
Yeah.
So that's myself and another developer, the lead developer of Subsonic. We are working on a home server version, but the one I'm running right now is really, I call it the Frankenstein build, because currently myself and two other people are the only ones who have access to this video prototype of Subsonic. So that's why probably a lot of people haven't heard about it yet, because Subsonic people associate with music only. And that's all about to change and revolutionize for the mobile device, as well as just for desktops and playing videos. So anyway, roughly the 24,000 songs, they're all mostly in MP3 quality. Subsonic automatically downloads the album artwork for you that you're missing, so it shows up on your phone, shows up on your desktop. And most of the interesting thing about Subsonic is that it streams in different quality depending on your bandwidth and that kind of stuff, but for the most part, you always get at least one, anywhere from 128 to 256, and it never stutters. So for me to not have to, literally, I never use my iPod anymore now, because to be able to just stream any song you want to your phone or to wherever you are and just be able to hit the play now button, why would you be lugging a device with you that runs out in 8 hours of battery life? So that's really been how we manage the music.
Christian, if folks wanted to know more about that Subsonic solution, what's the best place for them to start?
Yeah, the best place to start would be going right to subsonic.org. That has the current version, which as of right now is 4.2. Again, about to change with all the new stuff coming out. It's very easy to set up. It's not that you have to have a server to run Subsonic. It can run on a multitude of different platforms. You could even configure it for your desktop. You just need to make sure if you want to be able to go out over the internet and not just use it internally within your house, you would have to configure a router, which is just a couple ports, and I believe Subsonic automatically attempts to do. But if you just have a Bose sound dock like I do in the kitchen that's Bluetooth, and you want to have Subsonic be the media manager where you just hit buttons and call music off your desktop or your server, that's the way to go. And of course, there's the streaming component. You can also contact me at webmaster@maplegrovepartners.com regarding Subsonic development or inquiries about Subsonic features and setup. Or, of course, at christian@theaverageguy.tv.
Excellent. Brian, we were talking a little bit about your setup, but we didn't come back to how do you store your music files and how do you listen to them back?
Well, I store them on my Windows home server. And to stream my content, I use a program called ZumoCast, and that's free. And it sounds similar to Subsonic. It provides on-the-fly conversion. So, for instance, the iPod Touch doesn't support FLAC files natively, but ZumoCast will provide on-the-fly conversion, and you can listen to it over your Wi-Fi connection in your home. I don't have an iPhone, so I haven't been able to test it over a 3G network yet, but it is capable of that as well.
Okay.
For players, I use VLC and FUBAR 2000.
Yeah, you pull these kind of these obscure software applications out, right? I mean, you're probably not the average guy when it comes to this kind of stuff. Right?
Probably not.
Yeah,
no.
Yeah, and that's all right. I mean, you have specific reasons why you use all those tools, right? I mean,
oh yeah,
they're not. Go ahead.
Like FUBAR 2000 is completely customizable. It's a lot more geeky, for sure.
Sure.
And there are, you know, add-ins and different configurations you can do to get, you know, optimum sound quality and get it to work and behave how you like it. But I really like it, and VLC is just kind of the player of choice that I use.
Sure.
You know, when I want to listen to a song real quickly, or you know, kind of get an overview of what a album's going to sound like.
Do you store it? Did I ask that? Do you store it on your home server, or do you? Okay, so you do in the music folder that's there.
Yeah, I have one for MP3s and one for my FLAC files.
Okay, so you just separate those two out,
right?
So you know what's what. You know, guys, I'll be real honest with you. You know, Christian, I've got about as much music as you, I think, and maybe a little bit less, but. I dump that in the music thing and in the music folder. For a while, I was trying to do all this high speed music stuff so the kids could listen to it and we could stream it anywhere. And nobody was using it. I was surprised. They all loaded up their iPods and that was it. They were gone, right? And anymore, I'll be honest with you, I don't even listen to it anymore. I've gotten so hooked on Pandora that when I'm out or even with my phone, I just, you know, I dial up Pandora, pick an artist or put a new artist in and just let that thing run. So maybe I've kind of turned into a radio guy. I could probably delete my music folder and not maybe shed a tear over it. Now, the family might say different. But at least at this point, I don't feel like we're necessarily getting the value out of our music purchases anymore that we used to. So my daughter, when she wants to listen to music, she just goes to YouTube.
And, right, yeah. Downloads the YouTube.
Yeah. I mean, it's a totally different the kids, and she's 12. They totally interact with music differently than my generation. You know, I got 20 years on you, and then your generation does it, and then I think the generation even behind you is doing it a little bit different. So it's always interesting to me the way people do it differently. I would kind of be your average. I used iTunes for a long time. It's just because it worked. Then we began, when the whole DRM thing blew up with iTunes, we moved over to Amazon and we just bought our music there. And then recently the Zune software has gotten so good at organizing and playing and giving it a nice visual effect. I'm just switching over to Zune at this point. It just works really well.
And I think we're in an interesting transition point where I don't know as if we can necessarily see it taking effect within the next couple of years, but I think we're starting to see another transition point into how we listen to our music back in. We're going back now, but I think it was back in like 2003, 2004 when the Apple iPod really started becoming popular. That was a revolutionary turning point for how people listened to their music, you know, and millions of people bought their iPod and people started managing their own, their own libraries and started creating their iTunes and their music. So I think it's interesting to see whether or not people are going to go with iTunes in the future and keep sticking with these players that aren't network enabled and just single files, or whether they're going to start finding ways to stream their music and make it available wherever they go. And I think that's going to take a bit of an education process on developing software that is easy for people to use, but I think at some point it's going to change again after it already has for the past several years.
Yeah, I think we're at a crossroads.
Yeah, and I used to use iTunes quite a bit when it first came out. But yeah, like you said, after the whole DRM issue, and it just started to really turn into a pig of a program, and adding a bunch of things that you really don't need.
Yeah.
Or, you know, don't like use ping. A whole lot.
Like what?
Like ping, right?
Yes.
This thing where artists like comments, like, what do I care about artists commenting about other artists? You know, it's your taste. You listen to the preview. If you don't like the preview, then, you know, you move on. But again, I think it's going to be interesting because we've had a major transition point with everyone getting their own listening device, whether it be Zune or iTunes or your iPod. But I'm going to place a bet that within the next, I'm going to go with the next decade to keep my bet safe, but I'm going to go within the next decade, music streaming to any device, people are going to start learning how to build their own streams and their own music libraries so that they can access it anywhere. I don't think.
I think it's
going to start to wear, and you're already seeing at the point where the latest generation iPod, that's not the iTouch or anything of that nature, has, you know, has video enabled. It's a small thing. It gets relatively nice battery. The screen's nice, and it stores X amount of files. People are going to start building the amount of music they have that it's going to be unrealistic for people to start paying for hard drive space when you can connect to a stream and have, and you know, you see those adapters, I think I'm right on this, those adapters for the iPod that give you, I think they give you wireless connectivity or radio access or that kind of stuff, but I don't see, even though I don't think the iPod or anything like that is going to die, I think the actual device itself is going to evolve into something that's able to listen to streams. And then this is getting really futuristic on you guys, but you know, imagine each all of your relatives and each of their families have their own stream, and you go to their house, you know, your iPod, here's Aunt Sue's stream, connect, and now you have a whole nother thing to listen to. So I just, and again, there's going to be sharing issues. We're probably going to get back into a whole nother DRM war, and the gladiators will be out on the internet, but I just don't see the same traditional model in the next 10 years.
I'll be honest. I'd love for us to get to just a subscription model for unlimited access and be done with it. So the Zune player model, which is $15 a month, I think, and I can move anything I want to my player, play it, get rid of it. I can't keep it. I don't want to keep it. I mean, I don't need to. You know, when I want to listen to Huey Lewis, I want to download it. I want to listen to it once. I don't want to listen to it again for another year or two. Type deal. So I'd just rather get, I wouldn't mind paying a monthly fee for the music. Let me listen to whatever I want to listen to, anytime I want to listen to it. And the whole hassle, I mean, we all do it, right? I mean, we just talked about it, but the whole hassle of ripping, storing, and having to get access to that music, in my mind, is just kind of ridiculous in a lot of ways. So I know you've invested, Christian, a ton into having, you've got basically a huge music server of your own. You are a Rhapsody in some ways, right? Or you are you are a Zune type deal. So I don't know. Well, good discussion about that. We should move on, or this is all we're going to talk about. We could talk about this for a while. Hopefully that's been helpful to the folks who've been listening. Certainly some music decisions that folks are going to have to make as they're cashing in their iTunes cards or their Amazon gift cards for music. And there's different ways to handle it. If you got some comments about what we talked about, shoot us an email, podcast@theaverageguy.tv, and we can bring that up in future shows. Okay, Brian, you are posting, probably as we speak at this point, a post on Windows Photo Gallery. I should say Windows Live Essentials Photo Gallery, right? So tell us a little bit about what you went through with that, who would use it. I know we've talked a little bit about that around Movie Maker, but summarize that post for us.
Right. Well, Live Photo Gallery 2011 is a set of tools for organizing, sharing, and touching up your photos. It also has the ability to create panoramas, movies, slideshows, and then publish them online to the cloud, like we talked about last week.
Oh, don't start that fight.
And it has a simple user interface. It integrates with Movie Maker as well. And it's free, and it should be really good for the average guy. You can add photos directly from your digital camera, touch them up, you know, get the red eye out, fix up other photo problems. And like I said, it's free and should have enough photo editing options for the average user.
Yeah, now last week you posted on Movie Maker, and I think I mentioned this on last week's show. I'll mention again, though, I spent a good majority of the weekend shooting No, I didn't mention this. So I spent the Christmas weekend, shooting some video for the Drobo post that I put up on the Home Server show last week. And I used Movie Maker to put those videos together. Very easy, very intuitive. I mean, you just, if you have two if you have two streams of video, like a 10-minute segment and a 15-minute segment, you can just put those together and then choose how you want those the transition between the two to work with just a drop-down menu. It is incredibly easy to make a really good-looking video, and shoot, I spent maybe 25 minutes formatting the thing. Now, is it the best thing ever? No. I mean, it's just me doing it. But it was easy to put a video together like we watched in that To the Cloud commercial where the guy shares it on YouTube with the grandfather. It really is one click, sign into YouTube. You have to have created a YouTube account, but sign into YouTube, shoot that thing up there. YouTube formats it. It's available, depends on how long the video is, but let's say 10 to 30 minutes, kind of based on the encoding that it needs to do. So pretty easy. So I imagine the photo gallery is the same. Brian, the photo gallery has some features, though, built into it from a stitching perspective, right? Did you cover that in the post? Did you see that?
Yeah, a panorama shot, mm-hmm. which is a representation of physical space in your photos using three-dimensional model. So you can take, say, three pictures, for instance, of a cityscape. And you take your three pictures and then you stitch them together, and it makes a nice landscape view to show more detail of the larger area of what you're taking a picture of.
Yeah. So you can create. I did that. That used to be a feature that was in a Microsoft product called PhotoSynth. And I don't know if that PhotoSynth has ever come out of beta, or if they, once they brought it into Movie Maker, that they killed it. I took about 8 or 9 shots, and then I put them together, and it automatically stitched those together for me based on the land formations and landmarks and some of those other things. Similar type deal, I think, right?
Right. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. So a great way, if you're on a mountaintop, to kind of do a 360 as well. You can kind of make some really cool pictures. I think my recommendation on that would be you take a lot of photos to make the more photos you have as part of the panoramic view, the better that view becomes. Would you agree with me there?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, yeah. So if you're going to do it and you're going to use it, really just snap off. It's just as many pictures as you can, and then let that application stitch them together. On the commercial that we watched or we listened to last week, you know, the gal was doing, or maybe we didn't listen to that one. There's one where the gal is trying to take pictures of her family, and none of the kids in the 6 pictures she takes, the kids all have different faces, and you know she can't get a perfect one, and she goes through and replaces the kids' faces with different, you know, with the best shot available to her. So that's another feature that's available there. Kind of the Adobe Photoshop for the average guy is kind of what I call it. The ability to do some picture touch up without necessarily a lot of work associated with it.
It's not necessarily the choice for professionals, but it's definitely perfect for the average guy.
Right. It's perfect for To the Cloud. The other feature in that is also you can do, it'll do facial recognition. So you can bring in your library, and it will start to ask you, "Hey, who is this person?" And it'll look in your contacts for them, and then you can start tagging the pictures in there, and then as it learns, it will start auto-tagging that stuff for you. So you could say, give me all the pictures of Jim. And all my pictures in there where my face is tagged or where it finds my face or it thinks it's me, it'll bring those pictures up. So kind of an advanced visualization search of the pictures that you currently have. So I found that feature pretty cool as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. There's a lot of cool stuff in there.
Yeah. So if you haven't tried that out, and in the post you had said that Movie Maker and Photo Gallery come together, right? So if you install one, you install the other.
Yep. You put them together, and then so say you want to make a like a photo slideshow or a movie based on your pictures, it'll open up Movie Maker, and then you can go in and edit it from there and put over voice narrations or music and edit it how you want.
Okay. Now, Crom out in the Ustream asks this question. He says, does it embed the metadata directly into the picture files? Do you know? I don't know the answer to that question. Christian, Brian, any you guys know? Is it when you're changing that? I assume so. When you're making changes to the picture or you're adding metadata like face tags to it, is that adding it into the metadata section in the file so that that data goes with the picture if I pull it off the PC and take it somewhere else?
I believe it does, yeah.
Is that
easy way to check would just to be open up a quick project, do a quick tag change, and see if the file size changes on the picture.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't really tested that out, but I know you can go in and edit any metadata through Photo Gallery as well. So.
Okay. Yeah, I imagine it would.
So I'm assuming it does.
Okay.
I just don't have a definite answer.
Yeah, I think we'll say yes. And if you're not using it today, it would be worth investigating it to make sure before you start letting it catalog your entire photo collection.
Right.
Because it'll try. Mm-hmm. When you first install it, it'll try. Yeah, and so Crom also said Picasa, he believes that Picasa uses a separate database, and I believe that's true as well. Are you talking about the desktop version of Picasa? Because Picasa would be its competitor, right? Crom, also you ask, how does it compare to Microsoft's ICE? What is I guess I don't know what ICE is. You guys know?
It's an image composite editor from Microsoft Research, so it's really software that is not mainstream. It's just research. I don't know much about it, but I know it's an advanced image stitcher, so it's the same kind of thing where you're overlapping photos from a scene or a collection. But I haven't tried it out myself, so that's interesting. But I do believe it's utilizing some new technology such as Silverlight, so that's probably .NET framework as well. So that's an interesting thing to check out and put in show notes for sure.
You bet. Brian, I think you said it best that that this is probably an average guy tool and not your Photoshopping geek tool.
Correct, right.
Yeah,
it's free. It has a lot of functionality, but you're not going to get nearly the amount of features you would with, say, an Adobe.
Yeah, and I don't think we're trying to sell it that way. I think what we're trying to say, it's a great tool for the average person who wants to. He's got all these digital photos that needs to do something with them, but doesn't want to buy Adobe or doesn't want to mess maybe with another advanced photo editing tool to get that done. There are a couple cloud-based solutions for this as well. I mean, this Windows Live Essential is really a PC-based version, right? But there are some like Picasa where you could move all your files to the cloud and store them up there and then index them with some of these tools. So before you dig in, here would be my recommendation. Before you kind of dig in and choose one, give each one a try and make sure it fits the requirements that you have. Because once you start putting all that metadata in there, you don't want to do it again.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, and I mean, it's free. Try it out.
Yeah, for sure. Give it a shot. Give it a try and see what you like. So, Brian, thanks for putting that post together. And those have been really good how-to guides for folks. You don't dive into the minutia on those. But if folks were wondering, if your mom was wondering, how do I manage my photo gallery that I've created because I got a new digital camera for Christmas, you could say, hey, look, Mom, you can use, you can download this easy software, and here's the instructions to get it done. So that's what that post is really good at. So make sure you point them in that direction. Okay, do you think we got those questions answered, or at least we fumbled through them maybe? I think so. Hey, one thing I wanted to share with you guys, I talked about this on the show last night. So if you listen to the Home Server show, I apologize, but we have a few listeners that don't necessarily listen to that show. Had a friend of mine bring a PC over, and it was all hosed up with a virus, and they were all worried about their pictures. And I had set I'd set a backup. I downloaded Wala, WUALA.com. It's a French company that does PC backup. PC file backup. You give them a little bit of drive space. They give you a little bit of hard drive storage in their cloud. And I'd given them 50 gig, and they'd gotten 50 gig. And So I said, well, I thought I set that up last time, you know, like 6 months ago when you had this problem the last time. And they said, oh, we haven't messed with it. And so I logged in, and sure enough, it had been running all on its own, all by itself, backing up all the pictures they had put on the PC all the way up until yesterday, or 2 days ago at this point. And they were all in the cloud. And if their PC had been, you know, if the hard drive had not been salvageable, I could have logged in and downloaded all that. Christian, hopefully that's the right link. That link doesn't take him to some kind of spyware. It was all there for him, and it was just kind of nice to know that the only way backup really works in most cases is set it and forget it. It's got to be automatic. You can't be thinking about you can't have to do it manually all the time because you just won't do it. So we talked a little bit about this at the end of last week's show. I used that to kind of dovetail into the fact that for the last 2 weeks, I've been working on some posts around the Drobo. And the Drobo is an external drive enclosure that'll handle multiple drives, in this case, four. And you can just jam any size hard drives in there, attach that to your PC, and do backup to it. It's a really nice way, very easy way of taking three or four hard drives and creating some redundancy and some data protection around that. I don't necessarily want to go over that here, but I've got a post out at the Home Server Show. So if you go to homeservershow.com and look for the Drobo post in the featured section, there's some information out there about the Drobo and how it works. The latest post has got a few movies that I put together with Movie Maker. And so if you check that out and leave your comments, that would be fantastic. All right, guys, our hour has come and gone. It's always amazing to me how fast this time goes. Anything else you guys that we missed? Any questions in the in chat that we missed? Anything else you guys want to cover real quick?
I think that's good. Have a safe and happy new year, guys.
That's right. And it's bowl season and football season here in the United States. So make sure you get them all in. The real ones, I think, start tonight. And make their way in through the weekend, as well as the BCS ones next week. Don't forget, as a reminder, we are at CES, and when I say we, I really mean me. Sorry, guys, that you don't get to join me out of CES. I'll be joining Dave from thehomeservershow.com, as well as all the other home server guys. They'll get there Wednesday. I arrive Thursday morning. We've got a bunch of interviews and some podcasting set up on the show floor to do. We'll look at storage. We're going to look at anything that's iPad or slate or tablet related. We'll maybe look at some of the latest phones. I've got some interviews with the folks from Drobo, as well as a couple other enclosure companies like ICDoc and a new one called PopDrive. So watch my Twitter stream. If you're not on it, if you're not following me and you're interested in what we do at CES, which is the Consumer Electronics Show, follow me, Jay Collison. Yeah, twitter.com/JayCollison. And that's just the letter J, C-O-L-L-I-S-O-N. And that will get you there. You can always comment on the show, send email to us. I'm Jim at theaverageguy.tv. It's Brian and Christian. At theaverageguy.tv, you can ask us individual questions, as well as podcasts at theaverageguy.tv as well. Christian and I have got some work to do on the site and make that thing a little bit faster, but we continue to make improvements on it. And if you're interested in what we do out there, we do about a post every day. So pop out there, subscribe to an RSS feed. Oh, you know, we didn't talk about that. Maybe we'll do that next week or 2 weeks from now. I was going to talk about how you do podcasting, or how you subscribe to podcasts on your iTunes and all the other devices. We'll come back around to that later. There are links, and if you need help, just shoot us an email, and we'll give you some individual instructions on how to do that. All right, end of a great show. Thanks, guys. Appreciate your time tonight. Good work, and you both have a very happy new year.
You as well,
Jim. Same to you, Jim.
Okay, night. New streamers will hang around for a little bit, but everybody else, good night. Christian, it was too bad we had to lose your video feed.
Yeah, it's weird because it's really intermittent, but I think there's a couple other people sucking bandwidth upstairs. Could have been part of the thing there.
It was nice to have the video feed. I'm getting kind of addicted to this. this video feed thing. So it's incredibly handy to have. All right, let's see. Out in the Ustream, Easy PC, I see he dropped in. Welcome, welcome.
Sorry. Hey guys, Jim owes me a plane ticket at CES. I'm sure sending him reminder emails, you know?
Yeah, well, as soon as I make the big bucks off the Google AdSense we put out there, I'll send you money for a plane ticket.
Sure, as long as you can keep the site from crashing for more than someone click the ad, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I actually look forward to seeing some of the tablets that they'll be offering.
Yeah, I'll take a peek. I'll try and keep my eyes out open for that. And Krom, thanks for the encouragement on the show. What I'm hoping to do is, so I'll have my phone, and as we come up to things, I'm just gonna pop on Ustream, and it'll automatically tweet, and then we'll do the. I'll try and get the representative from the device right there. We'll ask some questions. We'll do some close-ups of the device. We'll hit stop. It'll save it to Ustream. And you can either watch it live on Ustream or you can watch it later in Ustream. Dave is, I think, going to be using Quick. Is that QIK, I think? Which is another video streaming solution. He'll have that. So if you're listening in the stream here, if you go to homeservershow.com/CES-2011, there is a link on the site as well. You can follow all our meanderings there. You'll want to follow that. I was going to try and do some stuff on the Average Guy site, but splitting those two is just way too hard. It's like having two Twitter accounts.
And there's definitely a frenzy over the some of these new Android tablets that are coming out. So that's something you might want to check out. And I think there's rumors that the Color Nook from, I think, Barnes & Noble is going to go on an Android platform. So there's going to be a boom there. So.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. There'll be absolutely zero Home Server Show stuff there. So we're going to
Hey, guys, come look at the Veil stand. Oh, never mind.
Veil is dead.
Well, actually, so we think, if you listened to the show last night, there's some speculation that they'll probably release Veil Beta 3 either during or right after the show. So that would be nice if that came out. I owe some posts using the Drobo S on a home server Veil with the DE removed. And I think that's a perfect test of how do you replace the drive extender functionality that's in the home server with another product.
They better hire a security team if they do Veil right at the CES, or they could have it on their hands.
Yeah, and Krom, you're right. Veil's not dead. It's still there. It's going to PC backup. It's still going to do all those features. Yeah. We've just got to figure out the best way to get the hard drive, you know, a replacement for drive extender.
We always like a bash.
Yeah,
I was just making fun of Christian.
Yeah, I know
what he said the other day.
Yeah.